On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Synology gets doged, Facebook wants to take the IT out of your network, and Cricket Lou tells us all about DNSSEC. It's Wyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 96, recorded June 23rd, 2014. Cricket Lou and DNSSEC 2. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by SmartThings, the easiest and most affordable way to create a smart home. Protect and control your home from anywhere with no contracts or monthly fees. For 10% off any home security kit, visit smartthings.com/twit and use the code TWIT10 at checkout. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But I'm joined by my colleagues, my cohorts, my co-geeks, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Chibert, so good to see you. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing pretty good, and I'm actually having a whole bunch of fun designing power monitoring devices for the Hawaii Natural Energy Institute so they can spend under $100 for the monitor versus $8,000 for the commercial version.
So you're giving them cheap power monitoring. I like that. When do I get some?
It's going to be under $100, and I should have a prototype done by the end of the month.
Wow, you do get some of the coolest jobs, I must admit. Someone else who gets really cool jobs is Mr. Curtis Franklin from Information Week. Curtis, you're home today. You're not on the road. You're not at a conference. You're not coming to us from a hotel. What's going on?
Well, it's one of those rare times when I am, in fact, at home. I'm here until Thursday when I'm going to be doing some on-site audio down at the Merritt Island National Wildlife Refuge, the first National Wildlife Refuge, and some cool stories coming out of there. So looking forward to that. And then next week, I'll be back on the headset because we're going to be on vacation over at Da Beach, which is a very fine place to be.
And actually, Da Beach is a popular internet cafe on the East Coast. Gentlemen, I think it's time for us to get straight into the blips. Starting with this, reeling from some not-so-great response from their net neutrality proposal, the FCC has turned their regulatory eye towards wirelessly connecting more than 10 million students for the 2015-2016 school year. FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler has proposed a plan that would allocate $2 billion in E-rate funds towards upgrading schools with Wi-Fi access. Some of the money would be freed up from the FCC reserve accounts, while the remainder will be taken from the 2014 telco bribe fund. I mean, from future sales of spectrum. Wheeler also proposed a new set of zero-tolerance policies to combat the fraud and abuse that has plagued the E-Fund program for the past two decades.
Well, this blip comes from Slate. Patent trolls are mortally wounded. Huzzah! The Supreme Court has issued its sixth and final patent law ruling this term. Each ruling was unanimous, and each was a clear rebuke to overbroad positions on patent law. Thursday's opinion in Alice versus CLS Bank was the most important, or at least the most newsworthy, of the half dozen patent cases this term. With this ruling, the Supreme Court sent a strong message about what is and is not patentable, moving us away from the problem of overbroad, poor quality, crappy software patents. Yay! Happy dance! Yeah!
Well, on a slightly less happy dance, earlier this month, restaurateur P.F. Chang got hacked with thousands of credit cards being exposed. Now, to keep the doors open, they've rushed those ancient carbon paper credit card imprinters to their roughly 200 locations. Now, I think it's amusing to think of a company that does revenues of over $1 billion per year resorting to 40-year-old technology. It's so slow. Now, how would you react if a waiter came over to your table with one of those little carbon machines with the imprinter? Still, it should serve as a reminder that the infrastructure our retail economy rests on is fragile, and when something goes wrong, we can get blasted all the way back into the 70s overnight.
gentlemen. Ending up our blips is, well, big data is big money, right? Well, maybe not so much. According to the IDC, storage had the worst quarter of growth in enterprise purchasing in the last decade, dropping 6.9% in the first quarter of 2014 compared to the same quarter last year and 17% from the fourth quarter of 2013. The biggest chunk of that decline was a 25% drop in high-end storage spending, specifically the spending for big data storage. Much of the decline can be blamed on saturation of the market, but with Dell seeing a 90% drop year over year and IBM experiencing a 20.5% free fall, maybe big data just ain't big enough for storage suppliers. Now let's go straight into the Enterprise Bytes. We're actually going to be moving down to one that I really like, and that's that Synology got doged. Well, no, actually they got hacked, but so hack many malware. Wow. Earlier this year, owners of Synology network-attached storage boxes noticed that their NASs were sluggish with abnormally high CPU usage. After a little bit of research, it was determined that the boxes had been infected with malware that installed itself onto a folder labeled owned. Now, this malware has been using the processing power of a number of Synology boxes, actually thousands of Synology boxes. Now, Synology boxes are actually quite popular, powerful in their own right. Many of the small to medium business versions use a dual-core Intel Atom CPU and have at least a gigabit of memory. So in parallel, these tens of thousands of boxes could provide a decent amount of cryptocurrency mining power. And that's what the hacker used them for. In fact, that was enough power for him to mine 500 million Dogecoin, which is worth about $620,000. Now, I want to throw this over to you first, Cheaper, because this is something that we predicted last year when we started hearing about some of these hacks for cryptocurrency, someone using a cluster, although that wasn't really a hack. That was just someone abusing their privileges in order to mine Bitcoin. We heard another one about a lab in MIT being used to mine Litecoin. We thought it was only a matter of time before some of these embedded devices started seeing malware that would use their spare CPU cycles to do cryptocurrency mining. And it makes sense because most of the time these boxes go unmonitored. Is this a trend? I mean, are we going to see more and more malware that targets boxes that traditionally have not been useful just because in aggregate they can provide a little bit of horsepower punch?
Well, keep in mind, this is, you know, very much what grid computing is all about. And the Synology box isn't quite an appliance. It is running a full version of Linux under the hood, and you can put a lot of really interesting things. And unfortunately, these hackers have taken advantage of Synology's policy of making their systems very open so that you can go and have whatever you want. Heck, you can even put a version of Asterisk onto your Synology box for a small VoIP PBX.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the scary things. That's the thing that is worrying people who have been using these boxes for small and medium business. For the longest time, they had been told, look, if don't use a server, use one of these appliances because it's easy. You just plug it in. You don't have to worry about getting hacked. You don't have to worry about security. It's just always going to work. As you said, that's sort of changed. We've seen these embedded appliances become less and less embedded. Curtis, let me throw this over to you. Do you think small to medium business, and even some enterprises that are using these appliances, these throwaway, buy-them-by-the-dozen type boxes, understand that there has to be regular maintenance in order to stave off malware threats?
I think that far too many companies of whatever size are of the opinion that anything that's marketed as an appliance is essentially an install-it-and-forget-it kind of device. Now, we know that that's not true, and frankly, their IT department should know that it's not true, but the executives, and in the smaller companies, this could be the person who controls everything from the janitorial supplies to the server, believes that just like their cable modem, just like their Wi-Fi access point, once it's installed, if they go through as much as changing the admin password, then they've done everything they need to do for that appliance until it's time to unplug it and put a new one in its place. We're going to see a lot more of these, I'm afraid, because the economics of putting more power into the devices is simply too overwhelming. It's not that the appliance will ever use the power. It's just that the cheapest solution for the developer is to go ahead and get a mass-produced motherboard with some industrial version of Linux installed. You simply don't use what you don't need for your appliance. But in most cases, again, because it's the cheapest thing to do, the rest of the Linux distro is sitting there just waiting to be used. And as we see in this case, some enterprising hacker can find some very creative ways to use all that extra horsepower.
Right. I mean, that's one of the things that we love about Linux, which is once you install a basic shell, like, for example, on a Raspberry Pi, you can just call down the packages that you need. Well, that's great if you want to make a small distro, but it also means that same extensibility means that someone who gets their hooks into an appliance like Synology's boxes, which use a flavor of Linux, they can use the same power to expand the functionality of the box to do what they want. Now, here's the thing. As fun as it is to talk about the hack, that's actually not the story. The story comes about 5 months earlier. You see, this exploit, what they used to get the malware on these boxes, was discovered mid-September 2013. Now, Synology released a patch within a few days. On September 23rd, just after the discovery, they made available a patch, and they sent out broadcasts to all of their users and all of the boxes that were set to auto-upgrade, saying, you should update this, you should get rid of this vulnerability, go ahead and install the patch. However, as we know, nobody did that, or at least next to nobody did that. And most of these boxes remained vulnerable. So in February of 2014, this year, they started getting tickets from users who were complaining about really sluggish boxes, boxes that had CPUs that were always running at 100% CPU utilization. And that meant that the thousands of users who should have patched just didn't. Now, Chivert, I want to throw this over to you because This is actually one of the nightmare scenarios of the advanced persistent threat, right? Which is, we patch the exploits, but no one runs the patches. That's something that the advanced persistent threat lives off of.
Yeah, I think one of the problems that a lot of appliance people make is that they are requiring a human to do the final approval on the update. Appliances really need to take a page from the playbook from Microsoft. Let your users set a time that it's okay to reboot the machine. Synology has a setting so that you can quiesce your server so that it uses less electricity at certain times of the day. Why don't you just put something in there saying if it's between this time and this time and there's a new update, apply the update, reboot it, everything's good. Too many people like turn it on and forget. And that's just not the way it works because there is a general purpose operating system under the hood.
Right. Curtis, this is something that has gone back and forth quite a bit where users hate it when someone like Microsoft forces an update. In fact, I've caught myself. I complain all the time when I've got a job running and I come back and the computer has rebooted because Microsoft installed a patch. So the first thing I normally do is I yank out anything that makes a patch automatically be applied. But then this is the other extreme, which is if you're going to wait for the user and wait for the user and wait for the user, then eventually you're going to have an exploitable box. Is there a happy medium or is the viewpoint never going to change of the user that they think they should always get final say?
Well, let's go back to the roots of the microcomputer revolution. The whole idea was that the user controlled their infrastructure. That is still a very powerful, powerful theory. Now, I'm entirely okay with a system that ships with auto update as the default, but allows a power user to drill in and take it off like you do. Let's face it. Someone at the user level of you or Chibert or I'll even say me or for that matter, much of our audience, they know enough to be able to say, yes, I'm going to take control of this, but I'm going to do it responsibly. For the vast majority of people, though, I think that going to a default auto update is the best answer. And I think we're going to see more and more companies doing that. If you want to look at the repercussions of the alternative, I've just got one phrase, and that's Windows XP. Just because you do everything in your power to tell people that they should update doesn't mean they're going to do it for a whole variety of reasons that each individual thinks is compelling. The key is to take the casual users and not even make it a decision point for them. If a company is small, if an IT department is small and unsophisticated, take that decision out of their hands. Leave it for the people who know what they're doing, the people who are going to treat the power the proper way.
Wow. Okay, so take the decision out of their hands. Cheebert, I tend to agree, even though I would rankle against it as an actual user, but haven't we reached a point where, since everything is interconnected, since all our devices share the same network, the same internet, that some of those choices need to be taken out of the hands of the user? Because if you've got boxes and you refuse to update in a timely fashion and your boxes, your network becomes a botnet, you're now affecting everybody else. Let me rephrase it in a different way. Synology did this right. They patched it immediately. They made it known that there was a vulnerability. They told their users. They even pushed auto updates out to the boxes that were set up to auto update. And all that had to happen was users had to press the update button. The fact that they didn't, or that they ignored it, or that they plain just didn't care, well, what does that mean for a company trying to do the right thing? Is there a way to win this game? I mean, I can't help but compare them to Microsoft, who was so vilified for doing constant patches. But isn't that now being responsible in the world of a connected IT infrastructure?
Well, yeah, definitely. I can't remember the name of the company. I was actually doing a little bit of searching for it. There was this one company I ran into in the last, I don't know, probably 5-10 years that had it so that the users couldn't change the auto update unless they did a tech support call or a tech support email that told the company, yes, you're at least sophisticated enough to know about tech support, and they sent you the code in order to unlock your box. I'm not sure that's going to work because that company doesn't seem to be around anymore.
Okay, that's pretty clear.
But it's a kind of an interesting approach. You know, if you're sophisticated enough to do blah, then we'll let you unlock it so that you can turn off auto update. Because in theory, you know enough about your system that, you know, you can be responsible about it. Don't know if it's going to work, but it was an interesting concept.
Interesting indeed. Now, let's move away from that before we tick off our entire audience. I want to talk about something that's a bit more interesting. Last week, Facebook announced they want to take IT out of your network. Well, what does that mean? Well, quite simply, it means that they want to move you away from some of the networking giants into some very interesting customized boxes for networking. Again, as I said last Wednesday, Facebook revealed a new technology that they dubbed the Wedge. It's a switch, kind of. It's really a switch and a microserver combined. It uses that microserver to run the Open Compute Group Hug, and as a 50 gigabit per second switching ASIC with plans to expand it up to 100 gigabits per second. It also has 1640 gigabit per second network ports, dual power supplies with AC and DC operation options, so that if you have a data center running on DC, you can just plug this thing right in. And it's all packed into a 1U pizza box. Now, Google, Facebook, Twitter. There was a time when the applauded solution was to build brown box servers based on off-the-shelf consumer-grade components. Now, Google even made a name for itself early in its existence by building their data centers out of stripped-down computers that you could buy at your local Best Buy with a lot of memory at the lowest possible price, knowing that some of them are going to die, but then they would just replace them. Now, all of those giants are using custom hardware, be it Google, be it Apple, be it Facebook, because that seems to be the more economical way to go. Cheebert, let me throw this over to you first. How did we switch from one to the other? How did the brown box solution suddenly become sort of out of standard?
Well, I'll give you, obviously, my opinion, and that is flexibility. These giants are moving around tons and tons of data. They need to be able to be nimble in how they do things. They want to be able to go and implement what they think is the best thing. And a lot of the name brand switches have all this hard coded in. They don't let you add it. They don't let you change it. It's not easy to rip out modules. In fact, it's almost impossible. Whereas if you're in an open computer environment like what they're doing now, all of a sudden you have the ultimate control. So you can strip down the switch so that only does exactly what you need, and thus you have a lot more CPU cycles in order to do the things that make you money rather than just sit in the background and eat up time. We're actually taking a really hard look at that for our undersea observatories, just because certain things just don't work on commercial switches or are so difficult to implement that, hell, we're thinking about custom switches, for God's sakes.
Yeah, yeah. Curtis, this seems to be SDN on steroids, or at least a really good implementation of SDN, where the traditional way to build up your IT capabilities is to build a DC, build a data center, build a server farm, build a data closet, whatever it may be, which means you have all the ports you might need, you have all the servers you might need, and then you just partition them and you allocate the resources as necessary. What Facebook is trying to do is give you a concrete example of what SDN looks like. You have not a switch, not a server, not something that you just build and then dump software onto the top of it, but they're asking you to look at your application, at your service, at your solution, and the hardware in a single go. That's a different way of approaching IT, and that's one that I could see enterprise having difficulty accepting.
Well, on the one hand, it's taking everything to the embedded processing model. You know, when you look at embedded processing, you do think of the hardware and software together. So in one sense, it's looking at that model. I think they're looking at a lot of advantages. Chebert talked about performance, and I think our last story gives us another example. If they have these devices that are the hardware and software, and they put only the application, only the operating system framework that they need on there, then there aren't these extra hooks that a hacker could use for doing something else. It really does tend to enhance the security of an infrastructure if you don't have all of these extra functions laying about. When we're talking about a company like Facebook, we get all wrapped around the idea of them being so big that they can do this. Like Chebert said, it's something that's moving downscale, and it's not just isolated to IT. Think about it. When you see a UPS delivery truck on your street, you are seeing the UPS truck version of this very idea. You cannot go to a truck manufacturer and buy a UPS truck. It's a solution that they developed, that they use, and only them. You see it out in other areas. The fact is that if you want to buy enough of something, you can have it made just to suit you. The thing that's remarkable about this is that technology is pricing in such a way that we're starting to see the point at which that custom solution is practical getting lower and lower and lower. And that's the real revolution.
Now, Chebert, I understand that, but there's something about the hardware guy inside of me who says, wait a minute, no, you can't take away my hardware. You can't take away my really cool network. You can't take away what I build in my data center. This idea of turning the IT person from the guy who builds the network into a solutions provider, what does that change about our industry?
Well, it's changing us from a stovepipe environment where everything's custom built for that specific thing to a more commercial off-the-shelf type of thing. What it does for the networking person is it gives them the ability to eventually start buying these brown box switches. Before, you know, the modules are so hard to integrate, so hard to set up, that it had to be integrated by specialists at a manufacturer like Extreme Networks or Cisco or whoever. But SDN is really and truly changing the way things work. Having a brown box switch where I can go and, just like Linux, add the modules I want, delete the modules I don't want, be able to go and say, I want to do my own brown box. Well, the day of the Facebook or the Googles only being able to afford it isn't that far away from the end user. I think we're going to start seeing manufacturers start doing more open source or more open platform switching. And that, I think, is really going to kick loose seeing SDN being extended into the small and medium-sized business.
There you have it, folks. Learn yourself some services. Now, when we come back, we're going to be bringing back an old guest from the show, Mr. Cricket Lou, our guru of all things DNS. Will be talking to us a little bit more about secure DNS and why we need it. But before that, I thought maybe we would take a moment to thank the first sponsor of the Twilight Riot. That's SmartThings. Brand new to the show, SmartThings is how you make your house smart. Sounds pretty simple, right? Well, if you've been watching the development of the connected home, then you've probably heard about SmartThings. They had a fantastic development story. Well, SmartThings makes it easy to protect and control your home with your smartphone. You can adjust the lights or temperature, keep track of whether your kids come home from school on time, and even check to see if you've remembered to close the garage door. And you can do it from anywhere using your iOS or Android device. Okay, enough of the PR talking points. You're probably asking yourself, how does this thing work? Well, that's simple. You start with one of these smart hubs. It's part of one of their three home security kits, which they call Smart, Smarter, and Smartest. Each kit contains one of these smart hubs and enough sensors, switches, and outlets to turn your home into a smart home in as little as 15 minutes. The first thing that you do is you plug this smart home hub into your router. Then you add all the sensors and the switches and the outlets as instructed by the SmartThings app. Then you enjoy remote control of all your things. Now, in addition to SmartThings' own sensors, you can add hundreds of other home automation devices. Everything from, the light control switches and the temperature control switches and even a couple of security sensors that you find from competing manufacturers like GE, Schlage, Honeywell, or Eon, as well as the latest connected devices like the Nest thermostat, the Philips Hue, the Wemo, the Sonos, and much more. Now, you get to choose the level of automation that you want. The Smart Home Security Kit is $329, and it includes one SmartThings hub, one SmartSense motion sensor, one SmartSense presence sensor, and three SmartSense multi-sensors, which are multi-purpose sensors for doors, windows, and drawers that sense when things are open and closed and can measure temperature, acceleration, and vibration. The Smarter Home Security Kit is $479. It adds an additional motion sensor, a power outlet, and a siren or strobe alarm. And finally, you've got the Smartest Home Security Kit priced at $599, which includes all of the above, plus another presence sensor, power outlet, and an outdoor light plug and control power outlet. Now, each of these kits provides a reasonable way to add smarts to your home, an affordable way to secure and automate your house without any of the contracts, monitoring fees, or hidden charges associated with a traditional home security company. So here's what we want you to do. We know that our audience is smart. We know that our audience are first adopters. We know that our audience likes things that make cool stuff. And this is definitely one of those things. To get started creating your own smart home, visit smartthings.com/twit. That's smartthings.com/twit. And you can save 10% off of the purchase of any home security kit by entering the code TWIT10 at checkout. You'll also get free shipping within the U.S. That's smartthings.com/twit. And remember to use the code TWIT10 at checkout. And we thank SmartThings for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. We welcome back to the show Mr. Cricket Lou. Cricket, it is so good to have you back.
Thanks. Nice to be back.
Now, you are our avowed knowledge source, our repository, our guru of all things DNS. And for the folks who maybe didn't watch the first episode with you, can you tell them a little of your backstory involving DNS?
Well, I fell into DNS almost entirely by accident back when I worked for HP in the late 1980s and ended up running HP's DNS infrastructure. I was the host master, which is the title they give to the person who's responsible for DNS within an organization, or at least they used to when I was young. And I did that for, I don't know, about 5 years. I joined HP's internet consulting program and worked there for about 4 years, started my own company and did DNS consulting and training. Had the opportunity to train a lot of folks who actually are still managing DNS today, and joined my current employer, Infoblox, back in 2003. So I've been there 11 years now.
So you've really seen DNS come and go. You've been there at its nascent stage. You've sort of shepherded it into what we have right now, and you've seen it become sort of the central hub, the greatest technology that everybody uses, but most people actually don't know about.
That's right. It's sort of the unsung service out on the internet. I think everybody relies on it. I like to say that it mediates every non-trivial transaction that occurs over the internet, but you know, very few people really know much about it.
All right. Now, let's get into it, because since the last time you were on the show, we had a couple of stories that we've actually covered here on Twiat talking about how attacks are on the rise on DNS, on the domain name system. Now, we knew it was coming, but it was only a matter of time before we actually started seeing the numbers. In 2013, there was a 200% rise in the number of attacks on DNS, and there was a 58% rise in the number of DDoS attacks on DNS, specifically on NTP amplification attacks targeted at DNS servers. Now, this is something that we were kind of preaching about. We thought this is going to be bad. I mean, if your DNS goes down, you're going to lose access to email. You're going to lose access to all the subsidiary services that need DNS in order to locate the appropriate server. Is this something that you saw coming? I mean, have you been watching the same data?
Yeah, we've seen much the same thing. And I think we did see it coming in a way. The external authoritative name servers that most organizations run, those are the ones that advertise your zone data to other folks out there on the internet. They're absolutely critical. If someone is able to mount a sustained denial of service attack against them, they effectively knock you off the internet. People can't send you electronic mail. They can't get to your website. It's perfect for extortion, right? If you're going to try to wheedle some money out of someone, you can knock them off the air and say, hey, you know, you've got some Bitcoin handy, fork it over, and we'll lay off on the DDoS attack. Of course, you know, once they pay up, that makes them all that more appetizing a target next time. You know, your external authoritative name servers are also public. They have to be available to everyone. You can't hide them. Everyone knows where they are or can find them with a single dig or NS lookup command. So they're very, very high profile and very, very high value targets.
Right. I do want to talk about one specific attack, because it was a big one, and it was one that made the news more than once. And again, it was the sum of all fears about DDoS attacks against DNS. That's about the domain hosting company called Point DNS. It was attacked by a massive non-NTP amplification attack. And, well, the registrar for 220,000 domains, so those 220,000 domains and most of their services experienced intermittent connectivity problems. Now, they were offline for hours. No email, no DNS updates. The attack was coming from non-spoofed, non-NTP sources, which was even more troubling because this wasn't an NTP amplification attack. This was someone actually turning a real botnet against DNS. This is an old-fashioned botnet attack now going after DNS. And, well, I think this is the scary part. 20 gigabits has become the new norm, with 400 gigabits per second becoming the burst traffic that we expect from one of these big attacks. The DNS just wasn't designed to handle that, right? I mean, what's one of the fatal flaws about DNS that makes it so susceptible to DDoS attacks?
Well, I say, first of all, that most people don't have that kind of bandwidth to the internet in aggregate. So that would saturate your pipes before you even got the traffic all the way to the authoritative name servers. You know, I think that part of the problem is that authoritative name servers are public resources. And so you can't really filter out traffic that is coming into those external authoritative name servers unless you know that an attack is actually underway. You can drop some obvious traffic, stuff from bogon networks, you know, stuff from your own address space, stuff like that. But generally speaking, you can't just say, hey, look, I'm only going to allow a few, you know, authorized queriers. You have to allow everybody to send you queries, and that means that, you know, you're allowing potentially a whole lot of traffic to reach those name servers.
Now, we've got Synac in the chat room who is, he's chanting something that I see a lot from folks who deal with DNS, which is UDP, UDP, UDP.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not immune, right? I mean, because traffic floods, you'll see it on TCP, you'll see it on UDP, you'll see it on ICMP. These floods, they don't know a boundary. They don't know a protocol.
Right. I mean, I think that maybe his point is that you can hurl a whole lot of UDP at someone. You don't have to worry about TCP connection setup. You don't have to worry about spoofing the three-way handshake. You just throw a lot of UDP datagrams at someone. And in aggregate, that can amount to a whole lot of traffic. So he's right in pointing out that UDP is different from TCP in that way. But, you know, you can also exhaust other resources.
Right.
You can exhaust TCP-based query slots in a name server. You can you know, exhaust SYN slots on a firewall, border router, whatever.
Right. Now, let's go down the list, and I want to borrow your brain to talk about some of the ways that DNS has been attacked. And this is just in that one attack against Point DNS. We've talked a little bit about the floods. Now, let's talk about DNS amplification. Now, how is this different from NTP amplification? When someone uses amplification in DNS to reply to a flood victim, how does that work?
The way that typically works is that they find either authoritative name servers or what we call open recursive name servers, which are just name servers that accept recursive queries from just anyone. Anyone can ask those name servers to look up, say, the address record of www.infoblox.com, and the name server will go off and, you know, do its bidding, talk to a few other name servers, find the answer, and return it. And typically what happens is that the attacker spoofs a query from the IP address of some target out there on the internet. So they're not sending the query from their own IP address. They're sending it from the IP address, say, of a web server that they want to attack. And since it's UDP-based, that's very easy to do. All you're doing effectively is just stamping the wrong IP address into the IP message or the IP header. And then when the name server does all of its work to find the answer, it replies not to the original querier but to the target. And the hacker, if he's clever, is looking for a relatively small query that will result in a relatively large response being sent back. And there are lots and lots of queries that'll do that. One of the most infamous of them is looking up type equals any records for ISC.org. That's the Internet Systems Consortium's primary domain name. And the last I checked, the response you get back for a query that's a little less than 100 bytes, I think, is about 4,077 bytes. So very substantial amplification.
Right, right. Let's talk a little bit about DNS cache poisoning. This is one of the ones I enjoy because it's very easy to demonstrate. But how would you define DNS cache poisoning? How is it that someone is able to poison the well, as it were, for when other people do searches?
Well, cache poisoning is a pretty simple idea. It's just inducing a recursive name server to cache a bogus resource record, one that might map, for example, the domain name of a popular website to the IP address of a web server that's actually under the control of organized crime, a hacking organization, or what have you. It's possible for a number of reasons. In the very, very early days, we had implementation flaws in name servers that made it possible to conduct cache poisoning attacks. A very early cache poisoning attack, in fact, I think the first one we saw in the wild on the internet, was called a cache perf attack. And it was made possible by the fact that name servers were just too trusting in the responses that they received. If a name server asked you a question like, hey, what's the address of www.infoblox.com, you could send back, in what's called the additional data section of the DNS message, an address record that was completely unrelated to what was asked. You could say, oh, yeah, and by the way, www.wellsfargo.com's address is such and such. We patched that, and we bought ourselves some time, and we thought maybe we were done for a while, but we had more implementation flaws. We had a lack of randomness in the pseudo-random number generator that we were using in the bind name server back in, 2007. We fixed that. But most recently, back in 2008, we ran into something called the Kaminsky vulnerability. Dan Kaminsky, I'm sure you all know, is sort of legendary for being a very, very bright guy with a lot of time on his hands, I guess. And the difference between the previous vulnerabilities and the Kaminsky vulnerability really was that the Kaminsky vulnerability is a systemic vulnerability in DNS. It's not an implementation flaw. You don't just patch it and make it go away. You need a permanent fix to it, and that's a lot more difficult than just, you know, grafting a better pseudo-random number generator into a name server.
Let's actually talk a little bit about that, because we could talk about protocol anomalies. We could talk about DNS hijacking, but I think the ones that most scare people are the systemic problems, and there are a few systemic problems in DNS. What are the most scary systemic problems that you see right now?
Well, I think one of the scariest is that vulnerability to cache poisoning. We developed the DNS security extensions as a way to address those vulnerabilities, the vulnerability to cache poisoning. But, you know, we've been at this. The first RFCs describing DNSSEC came out in the mid-1990s. So we've been at this now for 20 years. and the adoption rates of DNSSEC are really disappointingly low. So that's one of the things that I would say keeps me up nights worrying about cache poisoning attacks. Also because when cache poisoning attacks are successful, they're almost impossible to detect until, of course, all the money is drained out of your bank account or your credit card gets charged up or what have you. So that's certainly a big one. You know, I would say secondary to that probably is the vulnerability of all these internet-accessible name servers to various types of brute force attacks like DDoS attacks.
Right, right. Let's talk a little bit about reconnaissance, because this is something that I just got demoed by a security friend of mine who was showing me how he could probe DNS servers, specifically DNS servers running within a network, mm-hmm. to find all sorts of information about the computers on that network. Is that a systemic problem? How does that work?
That's not really a systemic problem. You know, there are some organizations that don't have that problem because they're very careful not to throw a bunch of information in their zone data that reveals a lot about their hosts. It used to be the case that there were certain record types that you might add to your zones that gave away a lot of potentially valuable information. There was something called an H-info record, which standard for host information, which would reveal the hardware architecture, I think, an operating system that a particular host ran. You could see where that would be really useful to a would-be hacker trying to break into a system. He could kind of, you know, tailor his attacks, knowing the version of OS you were running, knowing the host that you were running, and so on. But most people don't use those types of records anymore. Sometimes what you're revealing is in the name of the host. Sometimes, you know, if you call it, HP 9000, what I'm showing my age, talking about HP 9000s, I suppose they don't sell those anymore.
I still have one of those.
Okay. Well, if you reveal, the name of the host or even the organizational affiliation of the host, you know, this is the HR department's main server, you know, HR server 1, or, you know, this is, you know, web server 4 or what have you, that can also help somebody who's doing that kind of reconnaissance figure out what your network looks like, you know, what the role of various hosts on the network are.
Right. A few months ago, I had a friend, Raphael Mudge, who showed me an example offline. We actually didn't do this on the stream, of DNS tunneling. And he was using it with one of his tools so that he could masquerade traffic coming from a compromised computer as DNS traffic, which then tunneled through the DNS server, which he could then use to attack as in a standard botnet. Is that systemic? I mean, I haven't found a really good way to stop DNS tunneling.
Yeah, it's difficult to stop because, generally speaking, most DNS architectures allow, for example, the resolution of internet domain names from inside an organization. And as long as there's any path from the inside of an organization out to the internet via DNS, there's the possibility of tunneling. Mm. For example, if you're clever, you could embed the outbound data in the query name. The first label can be, you know, up to 63 bytes long. That can embed a fair amount of data. So you look up, you know, some embedded amount of data .hacking.org or whatever, and somebody sits on the authoritative name servers on the other side and watches that come in and then answers it with, say, a text record or a sync record or even something innocuous like an address record, again, that embeds the data, the return stream. So, you know, it's certainly possible to do. And unfortunately, in most organizations, DNS is not a particularly closely scrutinized vector. So in most cases, no one will notice that this is going on. It's probably happening at a relatively low data rate, of course, because it's not a very efficient way of carrying the data. But it's very stealthy.
Right. Oh, which, by the way, Synac had a really good solution for this. He said just print up an internet phone book and throw it into your car every year, and then you don't have to worry about this. But, no, but seriously, I do want to talk to you about IPv6. I do want to talk to you about secure DNS. We've got Retro D in the chat room who wants to know, how does IPv6 help to mitigate any of these problems? But before that, let's bring back the other two hosts of the show, Brian and Curtis. Chibert, let me throw this to you first. As someone who is actively doing network administration, how worried are you about the implementation of DNS at, say, the U of H?
Well, first and foremost, thank you, Cricket. UH runs InfoBlocks. And we actually run an InfoBlocks cluster, so that's pretty nice.
That's great.
What I am worried about is I'm just flabbergasted that DNSSEC has had so much resistance to adoption. You know, I'd very much like people to start closing that hole, because we actually thought, we're still not completely sure whether we actually had a DNS cache poisoning attack against UH. And that's a very worrisome problem.
Right. And actually, I know the perfect person to ask about that. Curtis, let's ask you, because as geeks, we tend to look at this and say, well, why in the world haven't people adopt secure DNS? This just, it doesn't make sense that you would keep using a system that is so outdated, that grew up before a time that we had to worry about security. Shouldn't every enterprise on the face of the planet have adopted this with open arms 5 years ago? What would you say about that?
Well, I mean, the obvious answer to the shouldn't every company have adopted it by now is yes, they absolutely should have. Why haven't they? It's interesting the way that all of these discussions today are looping back into one another, because one of the things that most companies hate most is uncertainty. And when the IT system works, they are loath to authorize any change to a functional system. I mean, this is why I have actually seen, for example, IBM AS400 systems, 20 years old, that were literally bricked up inside a wall because no one thought to change them and no one wanted to change them. As long as the power kept going, the application kept running, no one was going to touch that machine. That's the attitude that far too many people have towards every piece of IT. And the fact is that they can go in, type www.cnn.com and see the morning news. So they're not going to authorize any changes at all to the system that makes that happen. It's not until something comes along and forces them to understand that change is far less expensive than sticking with the old faulty status quo, that they're willing to look at making the sort of change that they should have been making all along.
Cricket, this is the old argument of the only way they're going to change is when it hits them in the pocketbook. And let me throw that back at you. I may know why secure DNS is better. I may know why I might want to change, but what's the financial incentive to change? I mean, yes, there's been a lot of disruption. Yes, there's been a couple of things that were hit, but there haven't been any stories about how someone used DNS to steal billions from a corporation. When do we reach that tipping point?
That's a good question. Just to rewind a little bit, I actually wrote an article for InfoWorld that should appear relatively soon about the reasons that DNSSEC has taken so long to get adopted. So if anybody wants to check that out, it'll be up relatively soon. And certainly Curtis is right that one of the biggest reasons is inertia, fear of the unknown. And I think that you're right. I mean, absent a mandate like we saw the Office of Management and Budget release that said, hey, look, if you're a federal government entity, you must deploy DNSSEC on your internet-facing zones by a certain date. Absent a mandate, we do have to have something that will hit somebody in the pocketbook. I think it's just a matter of time before someone falls victim to a cache poisoning attack, somebody who lives here in the United States, and you know, hooks up with an aggressive attorney, and the attorney goes looking for deep-pocketed folks to blame and finds that this person's ISP didn't have DNSSEC validation on the recursive name servers, and the online merchant that she was buying something from didn't have DNSSEC signed internet facing zone. So obviously they share some of the blame. So they'll go after them. I think that's probably inevitable. We've seen other clever approaches. The organization in the Netherlands that runs their top level domain .nl, which is an organization called SIDN, actually use the carrot as opposed to the stick approach. And since they are the ones who determine what the wholesale rate registrars are charged for registration of subdomains of .nl, they couldn't really say, hey, look, you know, we're going to charge you extra if you don't sign your zone, but we can give you a price break. So they basically said, you know, if you're registering a subdomain of .nl with us that's signed using DNSSEC, we'll give you an extra, you know, euro off the annual registration. And because the profit margins are so thin in that business, basically every registrar dealing with .nl had to jump at that.
I love our chat room. We've got Menace in the chat room who's saying, wait a minute, DNSSEC is big scope unknown, big scope untested. Anytime someone comes up to you and says, look, what you have, this new idea, this new technology is interesting, but we want to see someone else implement it first on a big scope across the enterprise before we invest time and money into making that switch. What's your typical answer?
Well, there are a lot of folks who have implemented at large scale. For example, Comcast uses it on the validation side on all the recursive name servers, I believe. And you can look at a number of very, very large authoritative zones that have deployed it. The root zone, the comm zone, the net zone, the org zone, most of the, well, not most, but a very large number of country code top-level domains have deployed it as well. Most federal government entities that run subzones of gov have deployed it. So there is actually a fair amount of deployment out there, and there are good tools for administering it, too. It doesn't have to be all command line-based, which I think is a fairly awful, error-prone way of doing it. Infoblox provides products that automate DNSSEC administration to the extent possible, and if you'd rather go the open-source route, there are packages like OpenDNSSEC that do the same thing.
Okay, now let's get down to brass tacks because we are running close, and I don't want to close out without actually talking about secure DNS and what it can do for the issues that we just raised. So we talked about a lot of vulnerabilities. We talked about some systemic problems with DNS. Here's the thing: there are those who, unlike the doubters, really want to go with secure DNS, but they see it as a magic bullet. You know better than that, right? I mean, you understand that secure DNS, as good as it may be at quashing some bugs, doesn't really address some others. What are the pros and cons of secure DNS?
Right. The thing to remember is that DNSSEC is really meant specifically to deal with cache poisoning attacks. It, in fact, exacerbates other attacks. If you sign a zone using DNSSEC, it typically gets from about 4 to about 7 times larger. Responses that are sent out from that zone get much, much larger. The reason that, for example, that query type equals any response from ISC.org is so large is because ISC.org is signed using DNSSEC, and the response includes all of these digital signature records, which are gigantic. It includes public keys, which are also gigantic. That's where you get that enormous amplification. So in addition to deploying DNSSEC, when you're rolling out DNSSEC on your authoritative name servers, you should also look at sort of companion technologies that help to mitigate the chance that your authoritative name servers are going to be used as amplifiers in attacks against somebody else.
What are the companion technologies?
Well, the open source version is something called RRL, Response Rate Limiting, which a couple of very bright guys, Paul Vixie and Vernon Shriver, came up with. And it's basically a common sense mechanism that says, if I see the same query coming in over and over and over again from the same IP address, at some point, I'm going to stop answering that query because I've already sent him the answer. If DNS were working properly, he'd have cached the response, and he wouldn't be asking me, 100 times a second for the same response. So it's basically a throttling or a rate limiting mechanism that operates per response and also per querier, and it's a good effective way of doing that. And then there are proprietary mechanisms for that. We have one at Infoblox called Advanced DNS Protection, which is a series of appliances that just do very, very aggressive filtering of all inbound and outbound traffic that they see.
All right. Well, what about IPv6? Let's bring in the question from Retro D. That they're kind of companion technologies, right? I mean, if you're going to be upgrading secure DNS, DNSSEC, you also want to be running IPv6 because that actually does address some of the vulnerabilities that DNSSEC can exacerbate.
Well, the two technologies are sort of orthogonal. You don't need to, for example, upgrade to IPv6 if you're going to roll out DNSSEC or vice versa. But certainly, if you were looking at putting in a new DNS solution, if you were looking at upgrading your DNS infrastructure, you definitely want to look at one that supported both because both of those technologies are coming, and they're both enormously important. IPv6... Again, it doesn't really have a direct effect on vulnerability to cache poisoning or DDoS or something like that. The security implications of IPv6 have more to do with, making it much, much harder to sort of walk through someone's reverse mapping space, walk all of their IP addresses, try to reverse map them to domain names and actually find out how many hosts they have and what those hosts look like. Because with the amount of address space that you're typically given in IPv6, it would just take an absolutely titanic amount of time to go through somebody's address space.
Jeebert, let me throw over to you for a bit here, because when you talk to potential clients, when you talk to administrators, when you talk to people who control the purse screens, strings, and I know that you have suggested DNSSEC, do you also inform them that if they're going to implement that, they do need to include those companion technologies?
Well, it's a little about that old Fram oil filter commercial, pay me now or pay me later. Yeah, you can run DNS alone, but if you're running some of the other companion technologies, it's going to cost you a little more on the implementation side, but it's going to cost you a whole bunch less when someone goes and grabs, some financial information or something like that. There's a lot of pieces that a lot of organizations don't put in. The very fact of the matter is there's an awful lot of people that are still running freaking stateful firewalls instead of running something that actually has deep packet inspection. I consider DNS kind of the same thing. It's not just one technology. It should be a cluster of technologies that give you better control over who can get to what when.
Got it. Curtis, what about you? In your discussions on InfoWorld, do you talk about DNSSEC? Do you discuss all the ramifications of trying to implement that in your network?
I tend to think that on InfoWorld, the answer is no, because to be brutally honest, DNSSEC is a little deeper than most of the executives who make up the bulk of the audience in InfoWorld want to get. Now, if you get over to two of the other publications that I'm involved with, Network Computing and Dark Reading, they're all over it. It really has to do with the nature of what executive we're talking about. If you are part of the IT infrastructure, then you absolutely need to know about what DNSSEC is, what cache poisoning is, all of the various vulnerabilities, and what you should have done long ago to prepare for them. If you are very high up in the corporation, then that falls into the category of things that is like the magic smoke that makes all our computers run. You know that it has to be there. You know that if something goes wrong, you're probably going to hear about it, but you depend on your IT people to make sure that you never hear about it. And both sides of the equation take that pretty seriously. So I think that most executives are blissfully unaware of this and happy to remain so for a long, long time.
Cricket, let's take those blissfully unaware executives. As Specs in the chat room has said, how do we bubble up awareness to them? As an evangelist for this technology, what do you think is the appropriate steps to be taking for the audience of this show, the IT people, the IT monkey, the IT manager, the guy who knows and can see the oncoming storm and needs to convince an exec that, yes, we need to make some sort of resource allocation here?
I thought by appearing here on the show, I was doing my part.
That is your part. Now, what's their part?
Well, I think that anything that you can do to educate management about these threats is worth trying. And, I try to write some articles about this. Maybe you can sort of print those out, fly them up the flagpole. See if anybody pays attention to them. We also try to have webinars, write white papers, and things like that. And, of course, there's a lot of press coverage. Curtis rightly points to Network Computing and Dark Reading as two excellent publications that cover DNS-related security issues, which I think are really important. So, flood your manager with as many of those articles, as many of those pieces of reading material as you can.
Yeah. Let's make one last round of the panel. Cheebert, let's start with you. So as the person among the hosts who is most actively engaged in monitoring networks and building networks, what bit of wisdom do you want to give to that IT person who works at the mythical 10,000-seat enterprise network about DNSSEC?
Actually, the piece of advice that I'd like to give isn't technology specific. The biggest problem I have with all the new IT specialists out there in the world is they aren't very good at organizing their thoughts and presenting it in a cognitive and easy to understand manner to their management. You know, like the chat room's been saying, management tends to have their eyes just glaze over, roll back in their head when you try to explain things. And a lot of that is because of the way people are presenting the information. I personally think that one of the most valuable things a junior tech can do is go join Toastmasters and learn how to talk in front of an audience without bumbling and stumbling and, you know, losing the attention of your audience, because that's one thing you're going to have to learn how to do. You're going to have to learn to sell technical concepts to people that are non-technical.
Thank you. Curtis, what's your bit of magical advice?
Well, the big thing is that I find myself in violent agreement with my friend Brian. Learning how to communicate is key, and it's something that too many IT pros don't take seriously as they're developing their career. Now, I'll add to that, an important piece is learn how to speak the language of your audience. So if you want to talk to executives who might or might not be deeply technologically sophisticated about this, put it in language they can understand. Talk about a cost-benefit analysis. Talk about a risk assessment and what the worst-case scenario is from a financial point of view to your organization. Put it in their language. Make sure you use simple terms, and you have a much better chance of convincing them to go ahead and make the investment that you know they should have been making all along.
Also, it never hurts to use pop-up books. Just make sure you use that in crayon. That tends to work. No, that's bad. That's bad. Padre, don't do that. Cricket, to you. Again, thank you so very much for talking about DNSSEC. Thank you for coming back on, because this is an important topic. You know, this is one of those fundamental failures that we have right now in IT, and it would be nice if we could move on to the technology that others like you have helped to create. So what is that advice that you would give to that struggling IT guy who can't really talk anything beyond his own mind, who needs to understand exactly what's going on, who needs to understand how we can push this technology and make it understood that it's a vital piece of the future?
Well, I agree with both Brian and Curtis. You know, working on presentation skills is certainly important. I think availing yourself of all of the work that's been done out there by the internet community is fantastic too. You know, whether it's using stuff that comes from vendors like Infoblox or stuff that comes from ISC or other folks who are part of the DNS community, there's lots of material out there. Lots of good organizations producing material that attempts to argue for the importance of deploying DNSSEC, response rate limiting, and all the rest. The great magical thing about the internet, of course, is that you can learn almost anything out there, and you can certainly learn how to make a case for DNSSEC and other DNS security mechanisms online.
Thank you. Gentlemen, I want to thank all of you for this fantastic episode. Unfortunately, we've used up all our time. You've spent another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 99 out of 100 DNS queries. I want to thank every member of the panel, but I also want to remind you that if you want to hear Cricket Lou actually explain what DNSSEC is, go back to episode 79 of This Week in Enterprise Tech. That was the first time he appeared on the show. Cheebert, let's start with you. What is it that the Twiat Riot should know about you? What have you been working on, and where can they find you?
Well, I want to tell Twiat Riot that if you are working on sensors and so forth, take a strong look at the new Arduino Yun. I just stumbled over it recently and found out it will be able to run on PoE, standard 802.3AF. And I'm going to be designing a bunch of power monitors for the Hawaii Natural Energy Institute. I will also be having a bunch of new articles coming out on infoworld.com. And hopefully very soon from CRC Press, Curtis and I are going to have a book on cloud security.
Curtis, what about that book on cloud security? Where can the Twiat Riot find it? I mean, when it's done.
Well, when it's done, with any luck at all, they'll be able to find it in their local remaining physical bookstore and, of course, on Amazon. And we're making sure that this one is also nicely available in ebook format when it comes out. So that will be important. As for me, I'm working radio at Information Week, at Network Computing, at Dark Reading, and starting right after the 4th of July week of EE Times. So if you are interested in the hardware side of things, then we've got radio for you. Speaking of which, if you've got a great story that you think deserves to be told, drop me a line. We'd love to talk to you about getting you on the radio over at one of the publications at UBM Tech.
Thank you, Curtis. And finally, and mostly, thank you to you, Cricket. Thank you for coming up to the studio. It's always great to have in-studio guests, for sharing your knowledge, and for making, as Sinak mentioned, DNS bearable. That's strange for us. Can you tell the folks where they can find you, where they can find out more information about Infoblox?
Yeah, absolutely. So our website is www.infoblox.com. I'm on Twitter at @CricketOnDNS. And one thing I just mentioned briefly is that I've got a couple of webinars coming up on Thursday of this week, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, on sort of an update on DNS security threats and how to deal with them.
And where do they find those webinars?
I believe that there's an event selection on our standard website. And, of course, if they're interested, they could always just get me on Twitter and I'll tell them.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, that's the best way to do it. Everyone right now go over to Cricket on DNS. Follow him, and he'll tell you where to find the webinars if you ever wanted to know more of the in-depth about DNS. Thank you so very much.
Thanks.
I also want to thank you. That's right. You are our faithful listener, our faithful watcher, all the members of the audience who let us do the things that we love doing. We love geeking out with enterprise tech, but we couldn't do it without you. So we want to make it easier. Drop by our page at twit.tv/twite, and there you'll find a little drop-down menu that gives you the option for having This Week in Enterprise Tech automatically downloaded to your device of choice. Do you want it on your iPhone? Sure, we can do that. How about on your Android tablet or phone? Yeah, that of course we're going to do that. What about your laptop or your desktop? Easy as cheese. That's right, folks. If you want the audio version for the drive home, if you want the video version for your mobile device, and if you want the high-definition video version for late nights with Padre, well, why not? Why not jump over to twit.tv and find out how you can do that? Also, Did you know that we actually do this show live? That's right. Every Monday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific time, you're going to find us at live.twit.tv. If you join us for the live show, you get to see all the pre-show, all the post-show, and all the bloopers. It's like a little reward for the people who want to join us each Monday. And as long as you're joining us, why not jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv? It's filled with some bright engineers, but some funny, funny people, and yes, some actually pretty interesting trolls. Go ahead and jump on in and be part of the discussion that is Twit. Also, if you want to know what's going on between my shows, I actually do this show on Monday. I do two shows on Thursday. I do Know How at 11 o'clock p.m. Pacific time and Coding 101 at 1:30, as well as Padre's Corner at 7 o'clock p.m. Pacific time on Fridays. Go ahead and follow me on my Twitter address at twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's at PadreSJ. Finally, I want to thank everyone here at the Brick House who makes this show possible, to Carson, my super producer, Lisa and Leo, and of course, my TD, Jason Howell, who right now is going to act surprised.
That's right. Who has two pointer fingers and can make it look like they're coming from my back? This guy right here. Wait a minute. There we go. All right. Twit.tv/arena is where you can go to find my new show, Android App Arena. Episode 3 is coming out this Friday, and I'm very excited about it. Sorry, I can't control the hands. Look, they just extract out of my back. See, I can't do anything about it. I'm sorry, buddy.
Folks, this is what happens when you work at Twit. In any case, I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.